From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we feature interviews with two great actors who are probably the two best interpreters of the work of playwright, screenwriter, and director David Mamet. Joe Mantegna starred in the Mamet films Homicide, House of Games, and Things Change. Mantegna also starred in Godfather 3 and Searching for Bobby Fischer. William H. Macy co-founded the Atlantic Theater Company with Mamet and developed a new acting technique with him. Macy will give us an acting lesson and perform a very short Mamet play. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Quentin Tarantino's new movie Pulp Fiction. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. There are reports of a confrontation between Israeli troops and the Islamic fundamentalist kidnappers of a 19-year-old Israeli soldier. Details of the possible raid against the Hamas captors are sketchy. Because of Israeli censorship rules, reporters in Israel are unable to provide further details at this hour. However, the Associated Press is quoting sources in Cairo, Egypt, who say the soldier was killed in the clash. The Associated Press says Corporal Noxon Waxman was killed in a village near Ramallah in the occupied West Bank, according to a Palestinian security official. The AP says the Palestinians holding Waxman apparently also died, along with two other Israeli soldiers, as the Israeli soldiers stormed a house where the 19-year-old corporal was being held. At least 20 of the attacking Israeli forces were reportedly wounded. The Nobel Peace Prize has been awarded to Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, Foreign Minister Shimon Peres, and PLO leader Yasser Arafat. There has been great controversy over this award. One member of the Swedish Academy that chooses the recipients has quit the panel in protest. Response to the award has been low-key because of the kidnapping situation in Israel. NPR's Mike Schuster says the Nobel Prize Committee isn't restricted in how it hands out the award.
It is not unprecedented for the Nobel Peace Prize Committee to, in a sense, make an unorthodox prize, that is, to give it to numerous people. In the 1980s, one of the prizes was awarded to the UN peacekeeping forces. You may remember that many years ago, the prize was awarded to concerned scientists who were trying to stop nuclear war in both the Soviet Union and the United States. So I don't think that the Nobel Peace Prize Committee feels constricted in making only one or two world leaders at the same time recipients of this award.
Yesterday, the Nobel Committee honored novelist Kenzaburo Oe with a literature prize. A federal district court has turned down Representative Dan Rostenkowski's constitutional challenge to his indictment on fraud charges. U.S. District Court Judge Norma Holloway Johnson has ruled the Illinois Democrats' challenge to his indictment should be denied because the indictment does not violate the Constitution. Rostenkowski had asserted the indictment had violated his constitutional rights. The government says consumer prices rose 0.2% in September, the smallest advance in 4 months. The Labor Department says the report was low because of a decline in energy prices. Meanwhile, retail sales rose for the fourth month in a row. The Commerce Department says sales rose 0.6%, slightly more than analysts were expecting. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are up 18.5 points at 3,908. Trading is heavy. This is NPR. A White House official says some elderly Cubans and unaccompanied Cuban children at Guantanamo Bay Naval Base will be allowed into the United States. About 27,000 Cubans who fled their homeland are being housed at the base, which is in Cuba. The admissions cover just a small number of the refugees there. U.S. policy has been to deny entry to any Cuban in the United States who has fled the country. The policy was recently adopted to stop a flood of refugees who took to the seas in rickety boats and rafts to escape. The Russian ruble held firm today under pressure from the Russian Central Bank. But critics warn the central bank is running out of foreign currency reserves. NPR's Anne Gerrels reports from Moscow.
Viktor Garashenko has been a thorn in the side of reform for years, yet though he's been charged with funneling credits to failing state enterprises, Garashenko seemed to have more lives than the proverbial cat, that is, until today. Garashenko had been blamed by top Russian officials for failing to predict and respond to the sudden plunge in the ruble. According to the official Itar TASS news agency, President Yeltsin signed a decree formally relieving Garashenko of his duties in accordance with his own request. But while he's been excoriated by many, there were fears Garashenko's departure at this critical moment might destabilize the economy still further. The central bank chairman is appointed by the Russian parliament, and bankers worried given the composition of the Duma, his successor might be still worse. In Moscow, I'm Ann Garrels.
Again, our top story. There are reports of confrontation between Israeli troops and the Islamic fundamentalist kidnappers of a 19-year-old Israeli soldier. Details are sketchy due to Israeli censorship rules. The Associated Press, however, is citing sources in Cairo, Egypt, who say the soldier, 19-year-old Noxon Waksman, was killed this afternoon in the West Bank. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The playwright, screenwriter, and director David Mamet has just written his first novel. He'll be our guest Monday on Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of our show, we'll hear from two great actors who are probably the finest interpreters of Mamet's work, Joe Mantegna and William H. Macy. First, Macy. He's both performed in and directed works by David Mamet. He starred in Mamet's off-Broadway hit Oleana and recreates the role in the movie adaptation, which opens next month. Macy co-starred with Mantegna in Mamet's films Homicide and Things Change. Now you can see Macy on the new TV series ER. Macy is the resident director of the Atlantic Theater Company, which he co-founded with Mamet. The company practices an acting technique the two of them developed. You're about to get a demonstration. When I spoke with Macy last year, actor Neil Pepe joined him to perform what may be David Mamet's shortest play. It's 2 minutes and 6 seconds long. Here's Macy to introduce it.
Mamet wrote this about how many years ago?
Must have been at least 10, more probably.
Yeah, Dave lives up in Vermont, and he wrote a collection of Vermont pieces called Vermont Sketches, as a matter of fact. And they're published in one of his books. This one's called Deer Dogs. And in many states, but I know in Vermont, if a dog runs deer, that is, if a dog chases deer, you can shoot the dog, because they have a tendency to run in packs, the dogs, and they'll run a deer to death. And so the law is, you can shoot dogs that run deer, because I guess the dog is supposed to be tied down. So this is Deer Dogs by Buffalo Dave Mamet.
Dogs running deer should be shot.
But who's to tell it's running deer? Law says you see a dog in pursuit of a deer, you can shoot him. Who's to say? Wait, you take Dave here, keeps his dog tied up. One day the dog, say Larry Thompson's dog, is running by. Dave's dog gets loose. Larry's dog's running deer. Someone sees it down the road later on, Larry's dog and Dave's dog. What does he do? Shoot them both.
How did Dave's dog get loose?
I'm saying a dog which is usually tied down, Dave's dog.
How did it get loose?
I'm saying one day when it is loose. I don't know how it got loose.
And was it running deer?
No.
How do you know?
Because it hasn't got a taste for him. It's a tame dog.
Well, how do you know?
Well, now, because it is a tame dog. You know that dog.
I know what you're...
Wait a second. I know what you're saying, that the dog is... Though the dog is tame, it gets loose, it starts running deer. Is that it?
Yeah.
But what I'm saying, this case, we know that the dog is tame. It's tame. It isn't running deer, all right? It's Dave's dog. It's tame. It's been tied up constantly.
How does it get loose?
Well, say Dave forgot to tie it up.
And where does it go? Where does it go?
I know what you're saying. It goes to the woods, all right.
What is it doing out there?
It's out with Larry Thompson's dog.
What are they doing?
Larry's dog's running deer.
And what is Dave's dog doing?
I don't know.
Well, I don't know either, but I'm going to assume it's running deer.
Would you shoot it?
Yes, I would.
You'd shoot Dave's dog?
Yes, I would.
You'd shoot Dave's dog?
Yes, I would.
Because you know that that's the dog that'll be caught. Not Larry Thompson's dog. That's the dog that will be caught. Shoot. It's a bad law. I'm sorry, I don't like it.
Well, you like it when you go out in the woods and there ain't no deer.
No, sir. No, sir. And I'm going to tell you one more thing. What the law... Wait a second. Now, what the law encourages a fellow to do is... I'm not saying you or me, but what it sets a man up to do is to say, I'm going to shoot that fella's dog. That's not right.
That's great.
That's deer dogs.
That's great. That's William Macy and Neil Pepe. Neil Pepe is the artistic director of the Atlantic Theater Company, and William Macy is the director of the company. I think listening to David Mamet dialogue has made me more aware of the indirect ways that we talk to each other, you know, the way we kind of talk around things almost.
Yes.
I'm wondering, there's so many, interruptions and overlaps in the dialogue in not only this play, but in a lot of Mamet writing. How do you rehearse that? How do you rehearse the rhythms with each other?
Well, the main trick is you have to finish the sentences. You have to know what the lines, the words that you don't say, you have to know what they are, or basically what they are. As far as the rhythms go, they're inherent in the writing. They reveal themselves to you when you rehearse the thing. Dave also has this acting technique, which the Atlantic Theater Company is all about, which is called practical aesthetics. And one of the tenets of that technique is that you can't act the words. You can only act the action. You can only figure out what the character, quote-unquote, the character wants in terms of the objective, i.e. what he wants from the other person. And you, through an analytical process, you figure out what that means to you. And that's what you act. Mm-hmm. And the words, essentially, are gibberish. You let them go. Let them come out as they will.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm thinking when somebody's talking over you, it's like a little collision in dialogue, and your impulse is to stop. I mean, well, some people go on, somebody else, you don't know whether you should stop or continue, but it's very jarring when it happens. Does that happen to you when you're rehearsing dialogue in which there are those overlaps and interruptions?
Yeah. Yeah. The first couple of times you do it, it's swell for the actor because someone interrupts you and you're... It's offensive. It's, well, let me finish. Let me finish. The trick is the 600th time you've done that speech to still be offended when you get interrupted.
Right. To still have it feel abrupt and like a collision.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's a great way of putting it, though. A bunch of collisions. It's like several people running down a hallway trying to get to the door at the same time.
Neil, thanks a lot for joining us for the performance
Absolutely.
Part of the program.
All right. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay. Bye-bye. Bill Macy, how did you start working with David Mamet?
I went to a school in Vermont called Goddard College, and David had just graduated, and he came back as, I believe they called him, a teaching fellow, and so he was my teacher. And he taught an acting technique that was roughly Stanislavskian, and more specifically, it was the way Sandy Meisner taught. And he was my teacher, and he was the most outrageous man I'd ever met in my life, and he started writing plays. He came in one day with this collection of short sketches called Sexual Perversity in Chicago. And just about all of us looked at this writing and thought, this is pretty peculiar. This is brand new.
So had you been directed by anybody before working with Mamet?
Oh, yeah. I did plays in high school and in college. But what David brought to it, the first thing that he brought to the whole... subject of being an actor, which is really what my early college days were about. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I just knew that the only thing I'd ever been successful at or enjoyed was acting. What David brought to it was a sense of pride. He charged us as students to look at the whole thing in a broader sense, what our role in society was and what our responsibilities were. And he did it from a very Russian point of view, a very selfless, either get it together or get out, the world doesn't need you kind of an attitude. And he impressed on us, as Stanislavski said, that the task of the actor was to bring to the stage the life of the human soul, which is a lofty phrase, but he brought it right down to the nitty-gritty. And as a result, he had a work ethic in that class, which has never left me and held me in good stead, and which I've been trying to spread in the community also. Such things as be on time. It sounds like a silly thing, but in David's classes, if you were not on time, which was about 3 minutes before the class was to begin, the door was locked. Don't come in.
Really?
Do not come in.
Were you ever late?
Once or twice.
And you missed it.
Absolutely. And a couple of times it would be after you'd spent all week working on a scene that you were dying to do.
And how was that good discipline?
Well, yeah, about the second time you were late, you decided, perhaps I should not be late anymore. It would be so much easier to be on time than to go through all of this angst.
Actor William H. Macy is my guest. He stars in David Mamet's film Oleana, which opens next month. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with William H. Macy, resident director of the Atlantic Theater Company. Your students have written a book called A Practical Handbook for the Actor, which is based on the style of acting that you and David Mamet teach. In the introduction to the book, Mamet says that most acting is based on shame and guilt. Was that your experience when you were studying acting?
That was my experience when I studied anything in school. It's true. It's particularly bad in the acting profession for a couple of reasons. One, there is such a thing as the muse, and every once in a while, she will visit the actor, and you do the best work you've ever done. And you go back after the performance and say, what was it that allowed me to be that good? And it is indefinable. And so that's a very seductive thing. And what a lot of acting teachers try to do is capture the muse. They try to contain it somehow. And it can't be done. It cannot be done. Sometimes God just visits you and you are wonderful that night. To put your attention on that is folly because it's not controllable. What you can put your attention on is technique. And technique is something that is within your control. And so as Stanislavski said, play well or play badly, but play truthfully. And I think a lot of acting teachers, because they have no technique, because they've never sat down and said, what exactly is the technique, not the art, but the technique of acting, because they've never answered that question for themselves, what they try to teach is feelings. And feelings are so elusive, and emotions, that they end up talking gibberish to the students. And as David says in that introduction, there is a conspiracy. The students will not call the teachers on talking gibberish, and as a result, the teachers will praise the students sometime and damn them others. And generally speaking, with a lot of acting classes, it makes no sense on an intellectual level. It offends your intellect, your intelligence.
Did you study how to use emotional memory for performances, and do you consider that a legit or a gibberish approach?
I did study it briefly, and it's just so much nonsense. It doesn't work.
Explain how it's supposed to work and why it didn't work for you.
Well, the Stanislavski technique broke down into two sections. One was emotional preparation, and the other was the sense of objective, the through line, the action of the piece. Stanislavski invented basically both of those phrases. In the early part of his life, he worked a lot on emotional preparation, which Lee Strasberg was the champion of. And the way it works is, if I'm going to do this piece called Dear Dogs, and I'm playing the character Bunchy, and I'm trying to convince the other character, Larry, that it's wrong to shoot a dog, I would come up with an emotional... I would figure out what the emotional state that Bunchy is in. I would come up with an analogous emotional state that I have been through and put myself into that emotional state, and the speech would then take care of itself. Well, that's foolishness on many levels. One, it's almost impossible to control your emotions, in my opinion. You cannot control your emotions. And to whatever extent you can, it's really outside of any usefulness toward acting. Two, acting, in my opinion, doesn't have anything to do with emotions. And as a matter of fact, they are beside the point. Acting has to do with actions, which brings us to the second half of Stanislavski. And Sandy Meisner at the Neighborhood Playhouse was the great proponent of that. and that is figuring out what the character wants and acting that. In other words, my only job is to get the actor that I'm acting with, in this case it was Neil Pepe, was to get him to change his mind. And it's my job to do that, me personally. William H. Macy, I've got to change Neil Pepe, not some character doing it, because the character doesn't really exist. So I've sort of spun off into the stratosphere on you, but the idea is you can't control your emotions, so leave them outside. They will come or they will not come on their own, and there's nothing you can do about it.
So you don't teach emotional preparation for a theater piece?
No. On the contrary, we say we don't care how you feel about it, and if you really want to know the truth, how you feel about it is relatively boring. I don't know who said it, but boring emotions are fun to indulge in, but tiresome to watch.
What's the most emotion-packed scene that you've had to do in your career?
I don't know. I've died a couple of times, and this play, Oleana, at the end, I mean, this woman has wrecked his life. But, you know, Terry, I thought it was interesting, for me at least, what happened to me over the course of Oleana, which ran for 9 months, was that I consistently found myself going back to that final scene, which is so emotional and so charged, and saying to myself, settle down, cut out all that stuff. Once a week, I would have to go back and say to myself, simplify, simplify, because I would just fall in love with these little emotional turns and explosions that I'd come up with, and I would try to repeat them. And they're just not, they're beside the point.
So what would you be throwing overboard specifically?
Well, you know, one night I would let out some earth-shattering sighs. As a matter of fact, I did that one night, and it was quite a swell moment. I was quite proud of it. But, you know, being the cheap fellow that I am, I tried to do it the following night. And it didn't sound like a sigh. It sounded like I had emphysema. And I think it was just awful. So, you know, like the third night, I finally got it together to say, hey, practice what you preach. Just let that stuff go. There's another rule here, too, which I think many actors fall afoul of, and acting teachers by extension, which is if you cry, the audience won't. If you get upset, the audience won't. What they're doing is having, they're vicariously, they're up on stage with you going through the thing at the same time. That's why we like to watch things. That's why our heart picks up when we're watching TV and the bad guys are right around the corner and the good guy's walking right into a trap. Your heart's pounding because you're there. You're part of the thing. Well, if the actors pump up the emotion and essentially tell the audience everything that they're supposed to be feeling, it robs them of the experience. Much better, play it close to the chest and don't let all of that stuff out, except the stuff that will come out whether you want it to or not.
Right.
And the audience will get more bang for their buck.
Now, you have your own theater that you co-founded in 1983, the Atlantic Theater Company.
I'm the godfather. It's not really my theater.
Right. Okay. I didn't mean it to sound quite that possessive. But what are the advantages to you of having a home base like that and not being completely dependent on other people's theater companies and other people's movies?
A sense of community and a sense of home. And, you know, I've been doing more films. That's what I'm trying to do. I've been on the road now for 2 years. So it's really swell to go over to the Atlantic Theater Company on 20th Street, and I walk in, and I know everybody, and my picture's on the wall, and I can borrow a buck to get a Coke and, you know, take a nap on the couch if it's not already full, which it usually is. They teach classes at Atlantic, so generally speaking, the place is packed with students doing what this game called the repetition exercise, which makes you think like you've walked into Bellevue when you... It's odd.
Well, now I have to find out what the repetition exercise is.
Well, you're supposed to... The big thing is to be in the moment when you're on stage. So it's this game that Sandy Meisner made up that is about being in the moment, and you simply repeat until something happens to make you change. I won't bore you with the details, but it looks like this. It sounds like this. You've got on a green shirt. I've got on a green shirt. You've got on a green shirt. I've got on a green shirt. You've got on a green shirt. I've got on a green shirt. You're boring. I'm boring. You're boring. I'm boring. So you see these two people doing this all over in every corner of the theater. Outsiders think,
And you find that useful?
Yes. It's a fabulous game. The idea of taking your attention off of yourself when there are 1,300 people watching you is quite a trick. The only people who... You know who else has a rough time with that? Boxers. The idea of taking your attention off of yourself when there's a 6'3" man who's been training all his life to knock your head off, to take your attention off of that and put it on knocking his head off, that takes guts. And I think it's analogous, the kind of guts that an actor has to have, to stand in front of those people and get your attention off of yourself and put it somewhere else.
What's it like for you when you do an audition for a movie and you get your time with the casting director, with the director, and you have a limited amount of time to make a good impression?
It's your worst nightmare. It's, you know those nightmares you have when you wake up and you say, whew, thank God I was only dreaming. Well, it's like that, except you weren't dreaming. It was real.
Right.
It's a hideous thing. It's hideous, particularly when it's a great role for you and you know you could just kick it to no end. And you've got to prove yourself to those people. And I happen to be rotten at it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not good at it at all.
What goes wrong for you at those auditions?
Oh, I have a tendency to get angry when I have to audition. And so, because I can't be angry, I end up being ironic and saying funny things that aren't that funny and are generally very insulting. They flew me out to L.A. one time for a series, and it had come down to me. I thought I had negotiated the money, which was more money than Canada takes in yearly. I thought my life was made. So they fly me out to L.A., didn't tell me anything. I walk into this room. There are three guys that are identical to me, sitting there looking like they're going to explode from nervousness. And it turns out, I didn't know the gig, but there are four of us for this role, and then there are four other roles that each have four people. All these people sitting in a room. I mean, if you could have figured out how to harness that energy, you could have run L.A. For a month on the energy of these people just sitting there sweating. And then one at a time, everybody goes into this giant room that had a 16-foot table with all these suits sitting at it, off in the dark, and in this lighted space, you get up and you do your thing. And they decide whether you're going to be rich for the next 5 years and perhaps a movie star for the rest of your life, or whether you're going to just get back on the airplane. Well, I freaked out. I walked into the room. I looked at these people. My hand to God, I looked at them and I said, would those of you who are important stand up? Well, that was that. They didn't crack a smile. So I went through and I did my audition, but yo, boy.
Oh, wow. Did you know you were going to say that?
No, I just knew that I was furious. It's so inhuman.
Well, Bill Macy, it's been great to talk with you. Thanks a lot.
You bet.
William H. Macy recorded last year. He stars in David Mamet's film Oleana, which opens next month. And he has a recurring role in the new TV series ER. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On the second part of our show, we'll hear from actor Joe Mantegna. Mantegna and Macy starred in David Mamet's film Homicide. Here's a scene.
I just saw the ATF. They were stolen, Sully. The Tommy guns were stolen. All the guns on this invoice.
Hey, you're better than an aquarium. You know that? There's something happening with you every minute.
What does it mean?
It don't mean nothing. Some broad got killed. She's dead now, okay? You're going to the ticket office, pick up Randolph's tickets. This is the big one, laddie.
Timmy, this other case.
Bob.
I got this piece of paper I found. Grofaz.
Grofaz. What does it mean?
I don't know what it means. I got this fella on the roof, the Jewish house.
What was he doing? Shooting at him?
I don't know.
Well, then drop it, Bobby. For Christ's sake, I don't get it.
Well, maybe you don't want to get it.
What do you mean?
Nothing.
What do you mean? Because I ain't a Yid?
Well, you ain't a Yid.
And so what? I'm an anti-Semite? What the f*** are you saying?
It's just not your thing, Tim. It's not your thing. It's my thing, okay?
Bob, I'm going to tell you what the old whore said, and this is the truest thing I know. When you start coming with the customers, it's time to quit. What is this?
It's a strap the guy tore off my holster.
Well, go get it fixed, will you? Go take a cooling walk, something.
You mad at me?
Yeah, I'm mad at you. I'm not going to invite you to my birthday party.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up from the archives, an interview with actor Joe Mantegna. He starred in the David Mamet films Homicide, Things Change, and House of Games. He also starred in Searching for Bobby Fischer, Godfather 3, and Woody Allen's Alice. Also, Stephen Schiff reviews what is probably the most anticipated film of the season, Pulp Fiction, starring Samuel Jackson, John Travolta, and Uma Thurman. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Several reports say kidnapped Israeli soldier Naxon Vaxman has been killed during a rescue attempt by Israeli troops. The clash apparently came near Ramallah on the West Bank. Details are sketchy because of Israeli censorship rules, but the Associated Press is quoting a Palestinian source in Cairo who has confirmed the death. The AP also says the Palestinians holding Vaxman also died, as did two other Israeli soldiers in the rescue attempt. The report indicates the Israelis stormed a house where the corporal was being held and at least 20 Israeli soldiers were killed. The Justice Department says it finds questions about payments made by Henry Cisneros to a former lover credible enough to prompt more investigation. The agency says there's a possibility that Housing Secretary Cisneros misled the FBI about the payments. Cisneros' lawyer made the announcement today. The Justice Department now has 90 days to decide whether to ask for a special prosecutor. President Clinton has hosted a formal send-off for Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide at the White House. The president said Aristide's return to Haiti is the start of a new era of hope. NPR's John Greenberg reports.
The mood was celebratory. Some of Aristide's staunchest supporters who once criticized White House policy on Haiti shared broad smiles with administration officials. The president tallied the accomplishments of the American operation in Haiti and formally ended all economic sanctions against Haiti, effective after Aristide returns home.
Ultimately, the task of rebuilding Haiti belongs to the people of Haiti themselves. Theirs will be a long and hard road. Each and every citizen must make a contribution.
Mr. Clinton made a pointed reference to Aristide's promise to step down at the end of his term. Aristide thanked the president for his leadership and repeated his call to his countrymen for no retribution, only reconciliation. This is John Greenberg at the White House.
Four of the nation's major toy retailers have announced they'll stop selling realistic toy guns. From member station WBGO, Madeline Brand reports.
The world's largest toy store, Toys R Us, announced its decision today, and Kmart, Bradley's, and KB Toys quickly followed suit. Their decision comes just weeks after a New York City housing officer shot and killed a child who was carrying a realistic-looking toy gun the officer mistook for a real one. There have been calls in the past after similar incidents to ban toy guns, but little has been done until now. Officials at the Paramus, New Jersey-based Toys R Us refused to immediately give details about the company's decision, but they did say the Western-style rifles and the plastic handguns will not be reordered after the current stock is sold. For National Public Radio, this is Madeline Brand in New Jersey.
On Wall Street, stock prices were mixed today. The Dow rose 20 points to close at 3,910. This is NPR. First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton and Vice President Al Gore today unveiled a new federal survey of 250,000 working women. A large number said they like their jobs, but they'd like to see substantive changes in the workplace. NPR's Chitra Raghavan reports.
Labor Secretary Robert Reich says while women are proud to be breadwinners, most work because family incomes have declined. Four out of five women surveyed, almost 80%, say they either like or love their jobs, but at the same time, more than 60% say they have little or no ability to advance in their careers. Not surprisingly, the women surveyed say they would like to see changes in three areas: pay, benefits, and better work opportunities and training. Two-thirds said getting higher pay is a top priority, and more than 50% said they are not getting paid what they are worth. The number one issue women say they'd like to discuss with President Clinton is the difficulty in balancing work and family and the lack of affordable child care. I'm Chitra Raghavan in Washington.
Wisconsin agricultural officials say more than 1,200 calves from at least three farms got toxic growth drugs. A spokesman says the animals were taken to a slaughterhouse in an effort to make sure none of the meat was eaten by humans or other animals. Federal agents who have raided farms in Wisconsin and other states say some veal production firms are using the highly toxic drug to promote growth in calves. Even trace amounts of the drug can cause illness in humans. President Clinton has chosen former Labor Secretary W.J. Ussery to mediate in the baseball strike. The president hopes negotiations between the sides will resume. Ussery was mediator during the 1974 football strike. He served as Labor Secretary in the Ford administration and headed the Federal Mediation and Conciliation Service under Presidents Nixon and Ford. Players and owners haven't met since September 9th, 5 days before the owners canceled the World Series. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Playwright, screenwriter, and director David Mamet will be our guest on Monday. So to get in the spirit on this archive edition of our show, we have a 1991 interview with Joe Mantegna. I consider Mantegna one of the best American actors today, probably the leading interpreter of Mamet's writing. Mantegna starred on Broadway in Mamet's Glengarry Glen Ross and Speed the Plow. He starred in Mamet's films House of Games, Things Change, and Homicide. You may also know Mantegna as the father of the chess prodigy in Searching for Bobby Fischer and as Joey Zaza, the elegantly dressed mobster in Godfather III. He also co-starred in Woody Allen's film Alice. In Mamet's 1991 film Homicide, Mantegna plays a detective who has no life outside his work. He's close to no one but his partner. His greatest gift as a cop is as a talker, the cop with the silver tongue who can persuade anyone to cooperate. In this scene, Mantegna is talking to the mother of a killer, trying to convince her that the only way to save her son is to turn him in.
Listen to me. I know that it stinks. I know that there's so much death in the world. I know that it's full of hate, Mama. I know that it all turns out wrong. Here we are. Here we are. We're the garbage men. You think I don't know that? I know that. Looking for something to love. You got something to love. You got your boys. That's something. Look in my eyes. I want to save your son. Before God, I want to save your boy. Will you help me?
Mamet has obviously put a lot of attention into writing just the right wording and the right punctuation to get his point across. And I appreciate writing that's done with that much thought because it forces me give it more attention and give it more respect so you're not so cavalier about, you know, what you're saying.
Do you ever improvise within a Mamet script, or is everything, you know, as it is in the text?
Well, I would say that improvisation in terms of the dialogue is pretty minimal and should be.
Why should it be?
Because you wouldn't, some writers write with the freedom for verbal improvisation in there. I've worked for Woody Allen. Now, with Woody, he will give you that freedom. In other words, but it's intentional. In other words, Woody will write his dialogue, but it isn't written totally in stone. And, of course, coming from working a lot with Mamet, as I have, my initial reaction when I first was working with Woody was I would give him exactly every word he has written it. You know, I'd improvise in terms of my delivery and things like that, as I do with any material. But he, early on, like at first or second day of shooting, I remember him saying to me, he says, oh, listen, Joe, you know, don't feel like you're locked to these words. You know, if you want to add some stuff or you just want to go with it or, you know, change this, that, or the other, that's fine. Go ahead and do it. And so, oh, well, okay, once I had that signal from him, then there were instances where I would you know, vamp or riff or whatever words you want to use for it as to making alterations as to what I'm saying. But that's Woody's style. That's the way he works, and that's how he writes. Of course, if he wasn't getting what he wanted, he'd be the first one to say, well, maybe don't say that. Say something else.
Right.
But where with David, it's a different ballgame because he just writes differently. He's a man who has specifically, I mean, he writes in iambic pentameter, so it's not unless a person naturally speaks that way, it would be a little risky to just say, well, I know you wrote this line, Dave, but I think I'll say it this way. No, that's not the way you do it. I mean, it's the same thing, again, making that Shakespeare analogy. If you're doing a sonnet from Shakespeare, you don't say, well, here, let me just put this in my own words. I think it'll sound better.
Well, you know, you play a cop who's very alienated both from, I mean, the guy's got no family. He's got no personal life. He's really seems to have no friends outside of his partner, and he's even alienated from a lot of the cops that he works with. And in the last scene particularly, all of that alienation, because there's been a couple of final betrayals, really register on your face. And I was really wondering what you were thinking about during the shooting of that last scene to get that kind of dazed alienation on your face.
Well, I tell you, it all led toward that. I mean, playing that role, it was a monumental role for me. It was the most difficult role I've ever played, and certainly in film, partly because I'm in, outside of the first minute of the movie, I'm in every frame. And that translates into working 12-hour days, day in, day out, consistently, week after week, under very harsh conditions, in very unpleasant environments, dealing with some very serious and disturbing things. I think when you're that embroiled in it, that kind of stuff starts to seep out through you, because I felt a lot like this person, this Bobby Gold. I even told David when we wrapped the film that of all the characters I've played for him, this was the one I was going to miss the most because I liked the man very much.
Yet you seem so different from him. I mean, you've been married a long time. You have two children. You seem to really, you know, like having a family. Everybody, you know, when I read about you, everybody has such wonderful things to say about you, and how you'd never say anything bad about anybody else, and how nobody has anything bad to say about you. Well, so it seems like such the opposite picture of this kind of isolated, alienated fellow that you play.
Yeah, and it's true. I mean, I enjoy my life. I mean, my family, my friends, I feel I live a very fortunate life. And I feel blessed to have that life. But yet I think all of us, even those of us who have been so fortunate to have had, you know, a wonderful life, there is that little bit in them, that isolated thing, not quite sure how to phrase it, but it's like you're born alone and you die alone, that almost kind of thing in you that says, I mean, we used to joke about it, with a phrase of, hey, you know, we're all in this alone. And there's some truth to that. So that, you know, no matter how fraternal we are, how much family we have, there's that solitary person that is ourselves that's, you know, we have to still deal with. And so it's just tapping on that and expanding on it and creating a character who's pretty much wrapped around in my case, let's say the Joe Mantegna, who's had these very lonely, isolated moments in his life, and just stringing them together and saying, "Now this is a guy who's had a hell of a lot more of them."
Can you think of one of those moments that you're thinking of in your life that you'd be able to share publicly?
Well, I actually, as I'm thinking about it now, I remember it was about 20 years ago. I just starting off my professional career as an actor. I was in my early 20s. And I remember it was a holiday. I think it was it was my birthday. That's what it was. It was my birthday, and things were all going actually very well for me. But my birthday's in November in Chicago. That's a pretty cold month. And for whatever reasons, and I can't even remember specifically why, there was nobody around for my birthday. And I remember I was in my apartment. And it wasn't a bad time in my life. As I said, I was working, things were happening. But for whatever reasons, there was nobody around. I wasn't involved with anybody at that time. And I remember sitting in my apartment. I was eating some tuna fish casserole that I had made for myself. And I remember sitting there eating it thinking, I guess I should be doing something. I should go out somewhere and do something. It's my birthday. I think I was 22, 23 years old. And I remember this terrible feeling of loneliness, of like just wanting to talk to somebody or just share something with somebody. And obviously it did have some impact on me for me to recall what I was even eating at that time.
Yeah.
And to be able to tell you right now. So thinking of moments like that and thinking that this is a character that perhaps has spent a lot of birthdays doing that and a lot of holidays doing that, that helps you really tap into certain kinds of feelings for, you know, the character, a guy who basically lives for his career, who lives for his job, and that's the only thing that gets all of his attention, and everything else is just his own personal life is a long string of eating tuna casseroles by himself.
Actor Joe Mantegna is my guest. He starred in House of Games, Homicide, Godfather 3, and Searching for Bobby Fischer. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with actor Joe Mantegna. I want to ask you about your role in Godfather 3. You played Joey Zaza, the gangster with the finest suits, and he's taken over the illegitimate Corleone business interests, and his people are dealing drugs, and he's basically going to war with the Corleone family. I thought you had exactly the right amount of kind of menace and style and all that kind of like public relations flair that that certain gangsters have.
Well, I felt that Francis, in a way like Mamet, writes and directs in a certain kind of a style. And for me, his style is almost operatic and almost regal. I mean, there's a scene in Godfather 3. It's a scene that I'm in and at the it's supposed to be a meeting of all the dons in Atlantic City. And there's a scene where they're passing around a table with jewelry and they're each picking, you know, rings or whatever, things of value, is to be taking as tribute almost, as gifts. I mean, that scene itself to me struck me as being so ancient Rome or something right out of, you know, the Renaissance. It had a majesty to it. And to me, that was how I tried to key into my character, that even though it's very contemporary, it's, you know, it's now, it's America, it's this world of gangsters and, you know, cops and robbers and whatever. But yet underneath that, there's a certain kind of style and sense of almost, you know, regal royalty kind of thing. You know, these are the princes and dukes and earls of this profession. And that's what I found really interesting about it.
I say to all of you, I have been treated this day with no respect. I've earned you all money. I've made you rich, and I asked for little. Good. You will not give, I'll take. As for Don Corleone, well, he makes it very clear to me today that he is my enemy. You must choose between us.
I thought you brought some of the same musicality and style to your lines that you bring to Mamet.
Well, that may be, and maybe that was on Francis's part it was intentional, on his part maybe to you know, have a character that had maybe something of that there. I don't know. But again, like I say, sometimes it's hard for me to separate, you know, who I am as an actor and who I am as a person. And, you know, I try not to self-examine it too much.
I enjoyed the recent episode of The Simpsons that you did where you play like a neighborhood gangster and Bart becomes a wise guy. how did that come about? You're working on that show.
They pretty much just contacted me through my agent. I think they just, you know, had an idea of that kind of character and thought I might be the right actor to play it. And so it was a lot of fun for me to play a cartoon character.
How did you change your voice for The Simpsons?
I just started talking like this, that's all. Just make a little alteration and you become Fat Tony.
I mean, that's, you know, changing your voice as an actor is, you know, just as, you know, Carpenter has to change hammers once in a while too. So it's just, you know, you make those adaptations as you need to.
You seem to be at a new stage in your career. You're much better known than you were, you know, just a couple of years ago. Is there a difference in the kind of screenplays you're being sent now and the types of roles that you're being asked to read?
Well, somewhat. I mean, I'm certainly getting more offers to do, you know, what I would have considered leading man roles, you know, years ago. And also, since I wasn't doing leading man roles years ago, it is kind of new for me. I still think of them. I think of any role as a character role, though. If it's a leading, what someone else would call a leading man role, in my attitude is, well, it's a character role of a leading man, because that's just my background. I've played all kinds of character roles all my life. So there, you know, there's more often are there's roles where I get to kiss the girl, you know, instead of shoot the girl, you know, which I perhaps had a bigger career doing. So it's an ongoing evolution. I just hope to continue to be able to work with people who are at the top of their game. To me, that's the biggest thrill, to be able to work with the David Mamets, with the Coppolas, with the Woody Allens, with the Barry Levinsons, with the Peter Yates, with the Michael Apteds. That's the thrill, you know, work with Nick Nolte, work with Al Pacino. This is what anybody in any profession wants to be able to do, work at the top of their game, and that's, for me, been the ultimate thrill.
One last question. What's the difference between playing a leading man as a leading man and playing a leading man as a character actor?
Less makeup, I guess. That's all. You know, I usually tend to just walk on the set and say, no makeup here. Just, you know, just let me know if my hair's in my eyes and, you know, cover maybe this one little blemish that, you know, looks like it's ready to go. Outside of that, let's just wing it, you know.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Actor Joe Mantegna, recorded in 1991. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll be hearing the latest in the case of Nachshon Waxman, the Israeli soldier who was kidnapped. We'll be hearing what it means for the Israeli-Palestinian relationship from two Jerusalem journalists, Israeli editor Hirsch Goodman and Palestinian journalist Daoud Kutab. Also on today's program, a report from David Moltbus on the race for the Virginia Senate seat of Democrat Chuck Robb. His main challenger, of course, is Oliver North. And we'll be talking with Jesse and Davia Nelson. They are two sisters, both of whom have movies out this year. Both of them are about little girls whose mothers died.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The latest version of the American dream goes something like this. Quentin Tarantino, a California video store clerk, keeps peddling his screenplays until somebody finally nibbles. Director Tony Scott films one as True Romance. Oliver Stone uses another as the basis for Natural Born Killers. And Tarantino himself directs Reservoir Dogs, which turns into a cult hit. Now Tarantino directs his own three-part anthology film, which wins the grand prize at the Cannes Film Festival. Is it as good as it's cracked up to be? Film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Pulp Fiction.
This is a movie you can fall in love with. It's so rich and generous, so intent on giving an audience pleasure. Tarantino is telling three stories here, but even the links between them are cleverly devised enough to be a source of delight. His setting is an underworld derived from old movies and from the dime suspense novels of the 20s and 30s, the ones that have come to be known as Pulp Fiction. It's a world of hitmen, mob bosses, worn-out palookas, and gun malls out for a thrill. Tarantino's canvas has been painted in lurid comic book colors, with lots of low-angle shots and bold close-ups that make his characters mythic and huge, even when they're saying the funniest things, which they often are. At the age of 31, Tarantino has reinvented movie dialogue in a way that a lot of people are going to imitate for a long time to come. For instance, his two-star hitmen, Vincent, played by John Travolta, and Jules, played by Samuel L. Jackson, enjoy convoluted, almost theological discussions about such arcane matters as the nature of TV pilots and the degree of eroticism involved in a foot massage. At first, the talk seems merely like virtuoso noodling, but the big surprise in Pulp Fiction is the way Tarantino uses his shiny pop surfaces to explore what's underneath them. This movie has scenes of almost infernal darkness and dread. At the same time, it examines the motions of luck, fate, and redemption. As in this scene, in which Samuel Jackson's Jules, the steeliest of professional killers, announces to John Travolta's slightly dumber Vincent that, in light of their recent narrow escape from death, Jules is about to change his life.
Now, whether or not what we experienced was an according to Hoyle miracle is insignificant. But what is significant is I felt the touch of God. God got involved.
You serious? You really thinking about quitting?
The life?
Yeah.
Most definitely.
What's she gonna do then?
Well, that's what I've been sitting here contemplating. First, I'm gonna deliver this case to Marcellus. Then, basically, I'm just gonna walk the earth.
What you mean, walk the earth?
You know, like Kane in Kung Fu. Walk from place to place, meet people, get in adventures.
They got a name for that, Jules. It's called a bum.
Look, my friend, this is just where you and I differ. If my answers frighten you, Vincent, then you should cease asking scary questions.
In a scene like that, you can hear the joy Tarantino takes in making words dance. In his dialogue, and in his plot, too, you sense him avidly pursuing the next invention, the next twist, like a kid on a scavenger hunt. But Tarantino can enthrall you as deeply when his characters shut up as when they babble. Some of the movie's most entrancing moments occur in two dance scenes, both with Uma Thurman, who plays the gang kingpin's wife. Moments like these have a poignancy that comes from Tarantino's mastery of rhythm and tone. He knows when to hold back as well as when to plunge ahead. He also knows how to direct actors. In Pulp Fiction, Uma Thurman gives the finest performance of her career. Bruce Willis exudes real soulfulness and mystery as a boxer with brains. Samuel Jackson is incandescent. And John Travolta, with his puffy jowls and stringy hair, gives a performance that's so touching and funny and endearing that you walk out playing and replaying bits of it in your head. The movie's over 2.5 hours long. Its best scenes come way too early, and it has 15 minutes in the middle that are puzzlingly dull. In other words, it's far from flawless. But you won't care. Pulp Fiction is a treasure box, and certainly, unless this fall turns out to be a season of miracles, the movie of the year.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. We'd like to welcome the listeners of KUOP in Stockton, California, which started broadcasting Fresh Air this month. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Kathy Wolf and Barbara Bogave. Barbara also directed today's show. Research assistance from Becky Cohn. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
After writing some of the most ear-catching dialogue in contemporary theater and film, David Mamet has written his first novel. Mamet's plays include Speed the Plow, Glengarry Glen Ross, and Oleana. His films include House of Games, Things Change, and Homicide. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for a conversation with David Mamet on the next Fresh Air.